just listening to this moment. Because we are together in this moment. And what does it feel like to be together? It feels safe. Because if we're together, there's really only us. And the scary ones are them. And the thing that's interesting, because when we recognize that truth, that when there's only us, there's nothing to be afraid of. We know it's true, and yet something in our culture, in our environment, in our karma, in our something, veils us again and again from the compassion of our own hearts, from the being with the universe with our own hearts. It's interesting because the whole spiritual journey has come to me more to examine what it is that turns you off from living truth, rather than how do you get there. It's as if you're already it, and you're just busy making believe you aren't. So you're busy thinking you're somebody. Now, somebodyness is very functional. We all have to be somebody. But the question is how much you invest that somebodyness with your identity. Is that who you are?
How do you do? I'm a lawyer.
How do you do? I'm a prostitute. How do you do? I'm a anything. Just previously at dinner, my colleague Jai Lakshman and I were reflecting that I had been doing this for 11 years since he's been with me. Actually, I've been lecturing for 35 years. 35 years I've been standing up being somebody who knows. Okay, that's very interesting. And I was at Harvard as a professor in Stanford. I mean, I really knew. But see, the predicament was I didn't. But you get into this game like everybody says, he must know, he's a Harvard professor. And then you, because they think that, you start to assume you know. And I was around a lot of knowledgeable people. And then later, because of a lot of things that happened to me, I was around a few wise people. And I noticed the difference. The wise people were very joyful, and the knowledgeable people weren't. Somebody knew something somebody else didn't. Now, did the wise people, were they joyful only because they made believe they didn't know what the knowledgeable people knew? Or did they somehow know what the knowledgeable people knew and also know something else? Is this too weird? Can you hear what I'm saying? Is it all crazy talk, or are you? We better take a vote. I feel your family. I really do. I mean, I feel we're all on the same journey together. I am just like you. You and I are both here because we are seeking truth and we're seeking to live in the Spirit. And we're seeking to let our hearts be open in the way we live. We're seeking to be free. We're seeking to be playful without guilt. Without guilt. Part of us is very material and individual and special and separate and in time and in space. We're going to grow old and die, and we're in space. We live here or there or move in boxes and stuff like that. And then there's another part of us that's just here. That's not in time. It's not in space. We're not going anywhere. We didn't come from anywhere. We're just here. You here, I'm here.
Well, I'm thinking of getting here.
Thinking won't do it. That's what's so far out about being here. If you think about being here, you're not here. Where you are is thinking about being here. Thinking is always one thought away from where the action is. That's why you're always thinking. People always have these funny looks on their faces, because they're like eternal voyeurists, you know? They're always studying it. They're always studying it. I'd rather be than see one, or I'd rather be one than... See, the trap, one of the really great traps is the trap of doing, of thinking you're doing something. The Bhagavad Gita says, Krishna says to Arjuna, don't get lost in thinking you're the actor. Knowing is doing something.
I know.
As opposed to I am. When you start to live on the plane of reality in which you are the body and you are the human heart that is breaking in the presence of all of the suffering to the earth and to all the people and to ourselves, and you are the thinking mind, you're thinking about it all, that is the condition most people are in most of the time. What happens in awakening is the recognition that all of that is relatively real rather than absolutely real. It's the recognition that there are other planes of reality that are equally real as what you can smell, taste, see, hear, sense, think about. It was an interesting transition I experienced when I stopped needing to know I knew in order to act. See, there's a quality of knowing that's intuition. We all have it, but we don't trust it, because we don't know we know. Our mind has so conned us that we think if we don't know something as an object, it doesn't exist. What the wise people are that the knowledgeable people don't know is what allows there to be joy in the presence of suffering. If you look at one of us that made it, Gautama Buddha, he huffed and he puffed and he made it. He got enlightened. And then he said, well, what'll I do now? Reasonable question. And he thought, I won't do anything because there's nothing to do. And then this astral somebody or other came along and said, there are some people for whom the dust is very light, so you can go out and teach. So he then taught for 40 years. I don't think he was attached to it, he just did it. It's like the sun isn't busy shining, it just is. Mahatma Gandhi was leaving a railway station and a reporter rushed up and said, Gandhiji, give me a message to take back to the people. And the train was already moving, and Gandhi grabbed a paper bag and he scribbled on it and he handed it out the window and it said, my life is my message. How about that one? Look at your life. Can you accept that it's your message? You want to put a postscript on it? Don't believe anything you just read? Are you sending what you want everybody to know? You are the gift. Are you giving it? Is it liberating people? Is it bringing joy? Is it bringing awareness? Is it freeing people from suffering? See, the far-out experience for me was to realize that to become free of suffering, I had to go towards it. I had to open to it. I had to embrace it. Or I have to. I am in the process. For years, I thought that I could be a renunciate in order to break my bondage to this plane of reality, the one I got incarnated into. Body, personality, somebody, thinking they're somebody. And so I did. I pushed everything away as hard as I could. It was like the battle of good and evil at some level. And all I seemed to end up being was a horny celibate. Somebody busy not living life. Not. I'm somebody that doesn't. It's like meditators. I meditate. Right, so what else is new? You know, what else do you do? I meditate. I'm a meditator. So many ways to get trapped. I'm getting enlightened. See you later. Pardon that my lectures aren't linear anymore, but I kind of gave up linearity. You know, that's for... Those are for people who... I mean, the fun is hanging out, and you don't sit in your living room being linear, for goodness sake, you know? I have the dial with the thing. I mean, I'm not linear at all. I watch at least a dozen shows at once. And they all bore me. They're equally fascinating. Does the Chinese curse, may you be born in an interesting time? It's interesting, in some of the stories, that is told a different way. May you be blessed to be born at an interesting time. And I've been studying why that is, why you think blessed, cursed. It's a curse to be born at an interesting time because you get lost in fascination. But once you start to awaken, it's a blessing to be born at an interesting time because it gives you so much to work with. It's interesting, there's a beautiful poem in which it shows the relationship between fire and water. And in effect, it says, for the unawakened, they seek water all the time, and fire burns. And for the awakened person, the fire is the water, and the water is the fire. That's really interesting. Because there's a stage in awakening where you move towards the suffering. You move towards what is in the universe. You move towards not shielding your eyes. You move towards the broken heart, the continuously breaking heart. I kept thinking that I could become free through leaving my human, the physical plane, which includes psychology. I could leave that plane behind. I'd become free in spite of it, as if it was an error. Like I'd constantly be asking God, who screwed up here? I mean, what am I doing among all these brigands, you know, and horrible people? I'm so beautiful. Alan Watts, once he and I were at a monastery together, we had been drinking of the altar wine a bit, and he said to me, Dick, this is who I was then, said, your problem is you're too attached to emptiness. That was wise, you know, that really was. It was extremely helpful to me, because he was right. Because I was attached. Like in the Sin Sin Ming, the Chinese patriarch statement, even to be attached to the idea of enlightenment is to go astray. there was a point where the whole renunciate direction, I realized that in the Buddhist teachings about mind, where it says that any clinging, it's the third noble truth, that any clinging, the second truth is the cause of suffering is clinging, the clinging of mind. And the third noble truth is let go of the clinging and you are free of the suffering. And the fourth noble truth is the eightfold path of how to do it within that system. As I saw that, I said, what is it that I'm clinging to? And I saw that I was clinging to my aversion of the physical plane. Because when I got high all the time, which I could do by meditating, fasting, psychedelics, whatever, I usually left behind the physical plane. High meaning another realm. And at some point, I realized that until I worked with that aversion, I would not be free. In other words, how about considering the possibility that my incarnation wasn't an error? I mean, just think of that for a moment. That's a big one for all of us. And that the entire thing is a curriculum, all designed for me. And I'm busy taking it. It's my personal curriculum. It's what's known as my karmuppance. So I turned around and I looked at my what it meant to be human, because I've been busy being holy for 25 years. That wasn't freeing me, obviously. And so I started to open to all the identities of being an incarnate, because you and I are two, we have many, but two interesting ones are the one where you think you're a separate somebody and the other where you're not, where you're just part of everything, where you're just awareness or you're just isness or whatever you want to call it. But when you got born into all of this, you went into somebody training. That's what a human birth is. I mean, if you didn't want to play, you'd be a blue baby and drop out. So you go into training to be somebody, and you become really somebody, and even somebody special in some cases. And because you are in training by other people who think they are somebody, the part of you that is nobody gets lost, because there's no support for it. Everybody becomes somebody. It's called ego development. We all have egos. Sure, the question is, do you think it's real? Do you think you are who you think you are? Don't be silly. Well, you're also that. But don't milk the melodrama too much, because you're more interesting than that. I'm pushing very hard tonight. But that's okay, because we're family. After you get trained in somebodyness, the way in which you are part of it all, you are part of consciousness, awareness, love, presence, isness, God, whatever you want to call it, the cosmos, you're a part of a network of infinite networks of all the networks of the universe. All forms are interrelated lawfully. You're part of all that. And then you learn that you're somebody. It's like the spring on a clock. I'm a spring. But you're also part of the clock. Like the Gaia concept comes along as if it's something new. It's saying you are part of the Earth system. You're part of the biotic community. But if you've been so busy seeing yourself as a separate human, you've lost that. You've lost that identity. It's really hard to do what Leopold said, think like a mountain. We can think about mountains. But it's hard to recognize you are part of the earth. For so long, humanity has been somehow control and mastery, or at the nicest, stewardship. It gives us a special little biblical twist. We're stewards. We're also part of it. Maybe an interesting sort of semi-conscious part, and maybe a kind of a parasitic growth that the system will just spew out after a little while and nobody will notice. I mean, who will there be to notice? That's, by the way, pretty likely. And I'm not even a pessimist. See, what's going to be interesting for you and I is, how do you find joy in the presence of death? Your own and everybody else's. How do you find joy in the presence of suffering? What is joy? Do I have joy? When am I joyful? Why is it that for 11 years I've always been, or even 30 years, I've always been afraid to lecture? Who's afraid is always somebody. Somebody who's going to stand up here and you're going to be out there, all judging me. The part of me that isn't identified with my somebodyness loves these moments. Because it's a chance for us to hear each other. You here, I'm here. When I was a psychologist, I was extremely neurotic. Many of you have heard this, but it's just so essencing. I don't mind golden oldies at all. And I had all these neuroses, I mean, really good garden variety neuroses, but they were all huge and very, very imposing. And a neurosis would come at me like, you know, like, oh my God, no. I mean, it would be like greed or lust or something, and it would take me over. I mean, it would just come out of the night, and it would take me over. And I go from being, you know, so nice to sort of a spiritual person to saying, wouldn't you like to come up and see my holy pictures? I mean, it's like, I would use anything in the service. I mean, once it took me over, it took me over. There was nobody left. I mean, I didn't know. So, speak about schizophrenia. I mean, every desire takes you over. It possesses you. That's who I am. I'm lust. You know, I'm sure you felt that, some of you. I have. But over the years, something's actually happened. I mean, as I gotten out from under being a psychologist, and all those neuroses are sort of now, they're all still there. I haven't lost one of them. I mean, if you're afraid you're going to lose a neurosis, don't. It will be there. It'll just get very subtle. But now they're these little schmoos. See, and they come along like some weird one, you know. Hi, haven't seen you in months. Come in, have tea, you know. They're like old friends. What are you going to do with your personality, you know? Bury it, you know? You can't bury it. It's like nuclear waste. You can't get rid of it. We're going to have to learn how to live with it. We grow up defining ourselves in a certain way, which is called our ego structure, who we think we are. And as we cultivate the ground behind that and acknowledge that there is space in which that exists, and realize that that is a broader identity in which we exist, then we see the ego as a functional unit that you use in order to function on this plane. You've got to be somebody. You and I have to interact through roles and through somebodyness. The question is, do we get lost or caught in them? And the image that is put forth by one of the Eastern saints is that if you imagine a horse and carriage, and the driver is up on the top of the horse and leading the horses, and over the years, the driver has never had anybody tell him what to do, so the driver has assumed that he or she is the master of the whole game and is constantly saying, I think I'll go left, I think I'll go right. And then at some point, which is the moment of awakening, the being inside the carriage knocks on the window and says, say, would you pull over or slow down? And the driver turns and says, who are you? And the person in the carriage says, well, this is my carriage and you're my servant. And the driver says, don't be absurd. I'm the master. And there is this moment where there is an interesting confrontation within oneself between who one thinks one is that has been running the show and this kind of deeper truth out of which we act that is a deeper wisdom than our somebodyness. And then, see, like, for example, Ram Dasness, I have no idea who that is. It's a functional entity, and people project into it. They say, hi, Ram Dass, or hello, Ram Dass, or Ram Dass, or Ram Dass, or Ron Dass, or whatever. And it's all these kinds of projections of mind that each of us has all the time. And we can either buy into them, or we just keep coming back to the center where we're none of them. We're none of them, and then we just use them as we need to use them. So that's the relationship between the ego and what you might call a higher self or the higher non-self. One of the interesting things you work with on the spiritual path is the projections of other people's minds. That people project their needs out into reality. We all do it all the time. So that when somebody comes up to me and treats me in a certain way, the question is, do I buy it? Or do I just hold on to my equanimity and allow it to, as I usually say, let it go through me like Chinese food? It just sort of comes through. And it's interesting because there's a tendency to want to buy it when it's good and want to reject it when it's bad. When people say, Ram Dass, I'm so disappointed in you. I really thought you, and you've just, you know, and you say, what does he know? Somebody else comes in and says, Ram Dass, you're the clearest you've ever been. I am so touched by you. You say, yes, isn't it so, you know? And you watch that process in yourself, and it's horrible. It's a horror show to fully acknowledge who you are, that you're still eating this stuff that doesn't feed you. It's like eating plastic. I mean, all of the applause and flowers and all, I'll tell you, when you get home, it's not worth anything. It's just empty. It's empty. It doesn't feed that place in you that's hungry. It's like an insatiable thing for that. And as you go deeper, as I go deeper in my being, I start to rest in a place of I am. I do stupid things, I do beautiful things, and I am. And then you come up and you say, you're wonderful, and I see your mouth go blah, blah, blah. And you say, you're terrible, and I see your mouth go blah, blah, blah. And it all goes through. And I weigh it to hear what's useful, and what isn't useful, I kind of set aside. And I notice that criticisms of me get much more attention than praise does. Because the critics often find the places where you have work to do. And I love that. I mean, that's the way suffering works. Now, my basic method, interestingly enough, even though I share all these other methods, my basic method is what's called Guru Kripa, or grace of the Guru. My basic method is my relationship to Neem Karoli Baba. And I formed that relationship in 1967. And he left his body in 73, after I had seen him really very few times in those years. And he is so present and real in my consciousness that my dialogue with him is the stuff of my life for the most part. I see you as another mask of my guru coming to me saying, I bet I can catch you with this one. I feel my guru goes around just through to central casting and keeps picking up masks and coming along and saying, and somebody comes along and says, Ram Dass, we're so impressed with you. We've decided to give you $1 million. And I see him in there saying, I'll get you this time, won't I? So, oh, thank you so much. And I feel myself. I mean, it's like you get sucked in. And he's constantly laughing at me, giggling, saying, remember God, keep surrendering, keep opening, keep listening. And he's loving me, and he's present, and he's hearing, and he's not just with me. And I feel that that presence, which has gone from a person to qualities of rascality, quality of wisdom, of emptiness, of love, of humor, all those qualities, they just pervade my universe all the time and keep affecting me. So that what I experience is that the process is interesting. It's as if this thing we're all playing with, it's like a higher truth, a love and a truth, an unconditional love and a truth, an isness, comes through from heart to heart. And that my relation to Maharaji allows me to open, and this stuff pours through me. Then somebody comes along and they experience it through me, and they think it's me, but it has nothing to do with me. I'm just a middleman in the process. And when you know you're a middleman, you get out of the way and you allow that thing to come through you. And the highest beings, when you read their writings, they never think they're busy doing it. So my experience is there is a way in which we can transmute ourselves so that we are instruments for higher wisdom and higher truth and higher love to pour through us out into the earth, into the arts, the sciences, the politics of social action, all of it, our human relations, all of it. What you experience is you're opening to it. What others experience is it's coming through you.
This is the end of side two. Please fast forward the tape to the end to cue up side one for your next listening.